You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last week, the CIA revealed that there is indeed an Area 51, although there's still no word on the existence of UFOs, extraterrestrials, and whether Elvis is still alive. On a more serious note, the CIA has also confirmed 60 years after the fact that it had played a role in the 1953 overthrow of Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. On the other hand, despite all evidence, birthers continue to fret about President Obama's origins and truthers about 9/11 conspiracies. In his new book, Reason magazine writer Jesse Walker challenges longstanding views on the role of paranoia in American politics. His book, The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory, is published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
When we use the word paranoia in a social or political context, are we using it in the same way that a psychologist might use it?
Absolutely not. And I say this at the beginning of the book. I'm using it colloquially, not clinically. I say that everyone is capable of the sort of paranoia that I write about, including you, me, and the founding fathers. I'm actually disturbed by the way that psychiatric labels are used to dismiss people and their criticisms, and I say that up front. I want to have that in the title, The United States of Paranoia. It sounds kind of nice.
You also emphasize that you're not assessing the truth of particular paranoid claims or conspiracy theories. But isn't part of what leads to calling a line of thinking paranoid that it is unsubstantiated?
Well, I mean, I say that at the beginning, and I should say that at various points I do say the evidence is or isn't behind different things people are claiming. But that's not the point of the book. I mean, the point of the book is to look at the stories and what they represent. If a story catches on with a large number of people, or even more than just a couple of people, it means that it speaks to their anxieties and experiences, whether or not it says anything true about the subjects of the theory. I think it's valuable to look at what people believe and why.
Do conspiracy theories always involve some secret organization or some secret power?
Well, it's some sort of hidden force, you know, behind the scenes.
Do all cases of paranoia involve some kind of perceived or imagined threat, or are there theories of good conspiracies?
Yeah, I talk about the idea of the benevolent conspiracy. In fact, I should say the first half of the book lays out sort of five narratives that recur again and again in American history. The enemy within, the enemy outside, the enemy above, the enemy below, and the benevolent conspiracy.
All still in the United States today?
Yes, all still around today and all present back in the 17th century where the book begins.
So what are examples of benevolent conspiracy?
Well, a benevolent conspiracy would include, for example, ideas about the Rosicrucians or some such secret society working behind the scenes to elevate humanity. It would include the idea of, you know, friendly extraterrestrials. It would include the angel boom of, you know, the 1990s, which in some ways the belief in sort of friendly space brothers was a secularized version of the idea of angels. And then in the 90s, we got this sort of resacralized version of the benevolent extraterrestrials. And it also includes, I think, any sort of idea, since those are, you know, fringier ideas that I just laid out there, any sort of idea that America has a special purpose. A purpose implies, you know, a person who gives it that purpose or a force that gives it that purpose. And I think that's been a powerful part of American history.
What about some things like fluoridation of water, which some people consider to be a real boon, mm-hmm. and others see as some kind of conspiracy?
Well, I mean, the fluoridation of water is being done above board. So it's someone who says that that's a good thing would not be saying there's a benevolent conspiracy.
Well, Cass Sunstein, who's a legal scholar and sometime Obama administration official, was a guest on our show a few months back, and he's an advocate of nudging, using incentives to promote better behavior. Could that be an example of benevolent conspiracy?
Well, first of all, Cass Sunstein proposes doing it above board, so it wouldn't be a conspiracy in that case, although there are people with conspiracy theories about Cass Sunstein, in part because of a paper he wrote in which he said that you might combat conspiracy theories by going undercover in conspiracy forums and rebutting them without identifying yourself, which is a good way for Cass Sunstein to guarantee that no conspiracy theorist will ever take him seriously. But, I mean, the nudging idea, I don't think that is conspiratorial unless you're trying to nudge in secret.
The birther and truther movements are obvious examples of conspiracy theories. How are the two, paranoia and conspiracy theorizing, related?
How are birthers and truthers related?
Or paranoia and conspiracy, are they always related? Or can we separate the certain things into one category and others into the other?
Well, there's certainly a lot of political paranoia that does not involve conspiracy theories. It's sort of a broad dread. And that sometimes coalesces into a fear of a conspiracy and sometimes not. In fact, I should have said earlier when you were asking about why I used the word paranoia, I said at the beginning, I'm not really pleased with using that word because of its psychiatric connotations. But the only other term I could think of was conspiracist, and that meant I couldn't include these things that are not about conspiracies. So I would say that conspiracy theories are a subset of the sort of paranoia I'm talking about.
Well, there are many different conspiracies that have been proposed to explain 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a conspiracy involved in birther thinking?
Yeah, well,
are people like Donald Trump, who continue to insist that the president wasn't born in Hawaii, exhibiting paranoid behavior?
Well, I think that if you believe that they're hiding the truth deliberately, then that becomes a conspiracy theory. Yeah.
When HIV/AIDS began to really get a lot of attention, some said that it was a government-created disease.
Yeah.
And that actually some people, I think, still continue to believe that it was kind of a war against people of color.
There were a number of different AIDS conspiracy theories. This kind of gets back to my point about conspiracy theories saying something true about people's anxieties and experiences, even when they don't say anything true about the subjects of the theory. Because when you had in the 1980s people saying, for example, that white doctors were injecting black babies with AIDS, that is untrue. White doctors were not injecting black babies with AIDS, but it did come on the heels of a long history of abusive and high-handed treatment of black patients by a white medical establishment, including some things like the Tuskegee experiment, which could, I think, be fairly described as a bona fide, actual existing conspiracy.
And that went on for 40 years, infecting African-American men with syphilis.
Yeah, well, and for those who are not familiar with it, the Public Health Service, starting in 1932, offered free health care to black sharecroppers and neglected to inform patients. I should put patients in quotation marks because this is such a horrible breach of medical ethics, that they had syphilis. And the idea was to study, you know, whether syphilis affected blacks and whites in different ways. And it wasn't revealed until the 1970s that this went on. So when things like that have happened, it becomes much easier to believe in other stories.
And we even have Johns Hopkins University recently revealed to have engaged in experiments without the knowledge or permission of subjects. So there are reasons.
In my backyard in Baltimore. Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, the book, as you said at the beginning, I don't set out to be the big debunker, and I don't set out to present the collection of conspiracy theories that I believe in. I'm presenting the stories, and this includes several stories that are true. I have a chapter on the investigations of the 1970s, the Church Committee and so on, when after Watergate, a lot of really terrible misbehavior by the CIA, FBI, other federal agencies was revealed. And the chapter, first of all, it explains these genuine government conspiracies. Second of all, it shows the sorts of paranoid thinking that was behind, you know, these FBI policies that, you know, led them to do things like COINTELPRO. And third of all, it describes how this sort of lowered the bar for people then imagining more far-out conspiracies. Because once you've heard that the FBI was infiltrating and deliberately disrupting peaceful organizations, it becomes easier to believe the FBI was doing other things.
My guest is Jesse Walker. His book, The United States of Paranoia, Conspiracy Theory. Well, you mentioned the Founding Fathers. How far back do conspiracy theories go in the history of the United States?
Well, since it was before the United States.
We have the Salem witch trials.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about Salem. I talk about King Philip's War, other events of the 17th century. So, I mean, I go back to the beginning of the colonial days. And frankly, if we had written records of, you know, the Native American settlements before then, I probably could have gone back much further.
We had the Red Scare in the 30s through the 50s. Didn't J. Edgar Hoover try to tie the civil rights movement to a communist plot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mean, I should say about COINTELPRO, which I referred to earlier, and which included a lot of, you know, infiltration and spying on the civil rights movement. It was, in essence, a government conspiracy to defeat alleged subversive conspiracies, which is how we saw things like the civil rights movement, the New Left, anti-draft movement, and so on. A government conspiracy to defeat alleged subversive conspiracies by convincing the alleged conspirators that they were being conspired against. Because not only did they infiltrate and disrupt, one way they disrupted was by spreading rumors that other people were the police informants, even though they weren't. And I tell some very bizarre and I hope funny, but horrifying also stories in the book that, you know, describe that.
And people's lives were ruined as a result.
Yeah, no, they were trying to bust up people's marriages, get people fired.
We also had Henry Ford, Father Coughlin, and others arguing that Jews were behind everything that went wrong with the world. Today, we have people like Ann Coulter seeing Muslims and liberals as being behind everything that's gone wrong with the world today.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of scapegoats have been grabbed at different points in American history. I think that the three biggest, when you're talking about conspiracy theories that involve scapegoats, in the United States, the three biggest have been blacks, Indians, and Catholics. There are all sorts of others, people targeting, you know, Jews, gays, liberals, conservatives. The big three in the United States have been blacks, Indians, and Catholics.
What have the Catholics been doing that I didn't know about?
Well, it goes back to the original colonial experience, and you know the colonies being forged in the context of these conflicts among Protestant and Catholic powers in Europe. And in fact, Maryland, you know, where I live, right after the Glorious Revolution in England. There was a revolution in Maryland that was fueled, and this was the one colony that was ruled by Catholics, although the citizens were predominantly Protestant. And this revolution was fueled by false rumors that the Catholics were conspiring with the Indian tribes to attack and kill Protestants.
Whites in the southern slave states feared slave uprisings, but there were some slave uprisings, like Nat Turner's in 1831. Were there conspiracy theories about enslaved Africans?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, scholars often have a hard time looking back at slave revolts and telling which ones were real revolts and which ones were just imagined by nervous whites. Nat Turner, you know, we know that happened. Other times it's a bit more ambiguous because, of course, the records we have are the trial records of these very frightened and paranoid, slave owners and others who ruled the society. But that's the classic form of, you know, what I call the enemy below stories, the idea of, you know, the lower orders of society plotting to overturn the social system.
Were there theories about the assassination of Lincoln?
Yeah.
That it wasn't just John Wilkes Booth?
Well, yeah, but not just Lincoln. I mean, that's what people still talk about today, but I actually opened the book by talking about John Smith Dye, who was a writer who published a book in 1864, so a little bit before the Lincoln assassination, which theorized that the attempted assassination of Andrew Jackson, which did in fact, you know, there was an attempted assassination in 1835, was caused by a Southern conspiracy of, you know, slavocrats. And then
but Jackson was a supporter of slavery.
Hold on. Let me carry forward here. And then went on to state, you know, forthrightly that William Henry Harrison and Zachary Taylor had been assassinated by the Southern slave power, that James Buchanan had narrowly missed an assassination. And then when the second edition of Dye's book came out in 1866, he added Lincoln to the roster of victims. And the interesting thing is this is not just like one nutty guy writing a book, which is the way when he gets mentioned in historical texts, it often is treated that way. He was drawing on rumors that had gone through Whig and Republican circles for years. In the book, I quote, you know, letters that were sent to Abraham Lincoln when he took office saying, watch what you eat. They poisoned Taylor and Harrison. They could do it to you, too. It came up during the effort to impeach Andrew Johnson when congressmen started, you know, spouting some of these theories. So this was part of the and Dye's book was, you've got a good review in The New York Times.
My guest is Jesse Walker, the books editor of Reason magazine, author of other books, Rebels on the Air, an alternative history of radio in America. His latest, The United States of Paranoia, a Conspiracy Theory, it is published by Harper, and we'll be back with more right after this. We are back with Jesse Walker. His latest book, The United States of Paranoia, a Conspiracy Theory, published by Harper's. People continue to speculate about the Kennedy assassination 50 years after the fact, including more than a few who linked LBJ and the CIA to it. Why do you think it lives on all these years?
The Kennedy assassination was like the opening shot of, you know, just such a series of events, not just the subsequent assassinations, but, you know, the riots of the 1960s, you know, the Nixon crimes. All the way up through, you could even carry it not just through the 60s and early 70s, but the late 70s. Up through, you know, Jonestown and the SLA, this sort of series of traumatic events that battered the country for almost two decades. And if you see that as the opening shot, naturally you're going to be interested in finding a villain that's behind it.
Well, so. We mentioned earlier the Tuskegee experiments. We're talking about events like these assassinations, also Martin Luther King, RFK, Malcolm X, at a time when we're also discovering that the CIA tried to assassinate Lumumba. Mm-hmm. We were involved a little later in the overthrow of Allende in Chile. There were real conspiracies that the United States government was involved with. There was a slew of movies in which when at the end of the movie you realize the CIA was the villain. It was killing all the good folks.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you're aware of the fact, I mean, it is a true fact that a couple of Black Panther leaders in Chicago were murdered by the police there, and you're aware of the fact that there were multiple gunmen in the Malcolm X assassination, you know, so there is some sort of conspiracy there. It does not at all become unthinkable that there was a government conspiracy, and I don't blame people for, you know, at least pursuing the story.
I'm assuming that one of the inspirations for this book is a 1964 essay by Richard Hofstadter called The Paranoid Style of American in American Politics, and he wrote of movements of suspicious discontent. There are waves of discontent, especially in connection to economic performance. Are there waves of suspicion or paranoia or conspiracy theory as well?
I should say Hofstadter serves as sort of a foil in the book. I give him credit for a couple of insights that I draw on, but I also push back against him in a number of areas. I will say, as far as, you know, waves of paranoia, I think it's not so much that we get more paranoid or less paranoid, setting aside moments like right after 9/11 when everybody was on edge, you know, just understandably. It's that there's different forms of paranoia. The paranoia points in different directions. An example I often give is I heard, and I'm sure you heard, lots of people saying after Obama took office, oh, look, there's suddenly so many conspiracy theories on the right. Well, throughout the Bush years, there were plenty of conspiracy theories on the right. They weren't pointing at the White House. They were pointing at, you know, Muslims and Mexicans and what have you. But it's just simply, you know, a new direction. So I think that it's the paranoia shifts, it changes shape, but it doesn't really get more or less very often.
Well, we usually hear these conspiracy theories from people on the far left and the far right.
Well,
are there moderate conspiracy theories?
I argue in the book that that the paranoia, political paranoia, has been strong in the political center as well as the far left and the far right. I think
examples.
I think anytime you have a significant moral panic, you know, it sort of seizes the mass media, people in government. That generally involves paranoia and often discussion of conspiracies. The most extreme and ugly case in recent decades would be the big panic over alleged satanic ritual cult activities in the 1980s and early 90s, which, I mean, I describe in detail this absurd episode of 2020, where they say
the television show.
Yeah, the TV show 2020.
Not my eyesight with glasses.
No. So, which, you know, a serious news program, which, as far as I could tell, did not interview a single skeptical voice. If they did, they did not put them on screen. And they did interview people who were sketchy characters who claimed, I mean, one guy who claimed to be a former Satanist and was not. The center does have its own forms of political paranoia. And I'd say furthermore the political paranoia of the center is much more dangerous because, you know, the more power you have, the more ability you have to act on, you know, misinformation.
But the difference is that you don't hear people saying today that there are people having satanic meetings where they are killing babies, they're roasting babies in the basement. That came and went very quickly along with the recovered memory movement. But you still hear people saying that that FDR knew that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor.
Well, the satanic fear, I mean, first of all, it wasn't very quickly. I mean, it built and faded over – you still had people in the 90s going to jail on sort of spurious accusations. But, you know, that's the nature of a moral panic, is that one comes and then goes and then something else comes along. And again, the damage it does is much greater than, you know, someone who's worried that, you know, that there are alien bodies in Roswell or something like that.
Do you think the reason that the FDR rumor has survived so long is that it is possible?
Well, there are. I mean, it's not the consensus historical position, but you do periodically see a book comes out from a historian who makes the argument.
Well, Gore Vidal argued it throughout his life.
Yeah, well, and that's, you know, not exactly a historian, but sure, that's in his – was it The Golden Age? Was that the novel where he brought that in?
Well, he told me it a number of times.
Yeah, no,
he,
I mean, he was –
And he claimed since he was close to government and he his family – I think he knew FDR. That was something that was assumed as a general fact within
that
family.
It's been resilient in part. What I was getting to is that there are various historians who don't think that's out of bounds, and it's certainly not out of bounds in the sense — I'm not endorsing the theory, but I don't think it's out of bounds in the sense that some of the other conspiracy theories that we've talked about here today are. What happens is, you know, somebody will write a book claiming either — I mean, not just FDR knew, there was one that claimed that Churchill knew and was tricking FDR, and it's taken seriously, but most historians don't buy it, but, you know, it keeps the flame alive, you know.
My guest is Jesse Walker. His latest book, The United States of Paranoia, Conspiracy Theory, published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Of course, there are conspiracy theories in other countries as well, but usually they're top down, like the doctor's plot and other plots during the Stalin years. You didn't hear too many. Are there similar kinds of conspiracy theories in other parts of the world?
Yeah, I mean, I say at the beginning of the book, I'm not claiming that Americans are more paranoid than other people. For all I know, the Swedes are afraid of everything. Who knows? You know.
Well, in Uganda, right now, homosexuals are being accused of being involved in a serious plot.
I mean, obviously, the Middle East has lots of conspiracy theories, Russia and so on. I write about America because, I mean, first of all, I'm from here, and you got to draw the line somewhere, and the sources are in English. But beyond that, I mean, the point of this book is to sort of look at the history of American culture through the prism of conspiracy stories and showing what does that tell us about America. Someone could write a great book about, the history of Russia through the prism of its conspiracy theories.
The Associated Press reported just yesterday that the New York Police Department has labeled whole mosques as terrorist organizations.
Yes.
Is there an element of official paranoia there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that that's a that is – I obviously that came too late for me to write about it, but I think that's in the long history of, you know, red scares and brown scares and, you know, yellow peril scares that this country has had.
And then if you speak to true paranoics, they will tell you that they're being spied on. Mm-hmm. Well, we're discovering that we're all being spied on right now. You don't have to be paranoid to believe that anymore.
Well, whether you're being crazy to believe it depends on why you think you're being spied on, I suppose.
How much of the paranoia you observe today revolves around religious divisions?
Specifically today, obviously, as you mentioned, there's a lot of anti-Islamic paranoia in the country, and I would say that's the most common type, although you have your standard golden oldies of anti-Catholic and anti-Jewish, you know, and so on theories as well that, you know, persist in the 21st century. I would also say that there's a close link between the history of American conspiracy theories and the history of American religion. I mean, I start this book with the Puritans. I gave you those four general types of conspiracy theories. The four that are not the benevolent conspiracy basically amount to sort of secularized, or sometimes not even secularized, if you're talking about, you know, ritual abuse scandals or the Salem witch trials, but secularized or semi-secularized versions of the devil. And the benevolent conspiracy is a secularized, or in the case of like the angel boom, not even secularized way of talking about, you know, God. So there's a very very close ties between religious thinking and conspiracy thinking.
As we saw in a movie like Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
But there's a huge body of American entertainment dedicated to conspiracy and paranoia. 3 Days of the Condor, Z, Clute, The Conversation, X-Files, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and its remakes, a bunch of films about JFK.
Yeah.
I just recently saw a conspiracy film from England where MI5 is behind a major conspiracy in killing off people to protect its own image.
Yeah, I talk about fiction and film and games and TV in this because that's part of how stories are transmitted. I think that having said at the beginning that I'm not setting out to either debunk or espouse conspiracy theories, that gives me a lot of freedom to move among stories that people believe, don't believe, half believe. And what you find is that there's an influence that goes both ways. There are movies and TV shows that draw on the conspiracy theories people believe, and then there are conspiracy theories that pluck elements out of fiction. I the Necronomicon has come out of H.P. Lovecraft's story and then gets invoked as like the secret text of the Illuminati. So there's a lot of interesting back and forth.
I imagine Philip K. Dick has set a lot of conspiracy theories in motion. Aeneas Nin said, "We do not see things as they are. We see things as we are." So what do you think American paranoia is telling us about ourselves?
I think that different stories say different things depending on who believes them, when, and why. But what I'm really trying and hoping to do in here is to sort of look at, you know, sort of this vast set of stories that people tell, and so that, for example, if someone believes there is a cabal plotting to impose a one-world government, that speaks to the loss of control that person, you know, feels over their life, you know, that they see that it sort of turned into an enemy with a name that's trying to remove liberty and sovereignty because they are feeling a loss of liberty and sovereignty.
And it's good reason for having a gun or two or 10 or 20.
Yeah.
In his book, Fear Itself, political scientist and former student of Richard Hofstadter, Ira Katznelson looked at how Southern Democrats use racial prejudices and fears to undermine FDR's New Deal. Fear can be deliberately employed to push political ends, and some birthers are still using fears about the president's heritage to try to block policy. How great a problem do you think paranoia conspiracy theory is today in just getting government to run or getting people to believe that not everything is going to ruin their lives?
It's funny. My takeaway from the Katznelson book had more to do with the alliances that FDR made with Southern racist Democrats.
But yeah, well, that's how he finally worked things out.
But who were, you know, delighted to have, you know, federal largesse coming to them. Getting to your question, you know, conspiracy theories can I hate to generalize. I mean, not only because they're the ones that actually turn out to be true. Let's abstract them away. We're just talking about mythical ones. We're not talking about the church committee. Sometimes it becomes just sort of a harmless hobby or leisure activity. Sometimes it leads to, you know, sort of the horrors of, you know, the FBI behavior we talked about earlier or the Red Scare. Paranoia motivates people in many different ways. But we'll never get rid of conspiracy theories. It's sort of inevitable that human beings, as creatures who naturally see patterns, create narratives, who have reasons to be suspicious and fearful, and who see the actual conspiring that goes on, are going to combine all those and have conspiracy theories. I was on another show last week, and someone said, "Conspiracy theories are toxic for democracy." And all I could say was, in that case, I sure hope not, because we couldn't have a democratic society.
Well, do you think that the White House is actually encouraging some conspiracy theories with revelations of the NSA's collection of Americans' emails or the attempts to prosecute whistleblowers?
Well, I mean, that's two very different things. I mean, the the revelations about what the NSA was doing was not coming from the White House. They came from Edward Snowden and The Guardian and The Washington Post, and good for them.
But the White House is defending it.
Yeah, but what I think is that the sort of intense paranoia that's interesting to look at is this leak scare, things like this insider threat program, as it is known, which is encouraging federal employees to rat each other out, to look for alleged indicators of behavior, which is based on sort of very dubious profiling, and which can really blurs the boundary between spies and whistleblowers.
Has the internet helped spread conspiracy theories further and wider than before?
I don't think it's further and wider so much as it's faster and more mixed up than before. And mixed up in the sense that, not in the sense of being more confused, but in the sense that you could have the hippie and the militiaman and the UFO buff all on the same conspiracy forum, listening to each other's stories and borrowing elements. But, I mean, I look at, you know, in this book, for example, I draw on, you know, a work a sociologist did in the American South in the 1940s, taking down conspiracy theories that white Southerners had about black Southerners, you know, feeling that you know, Eleanor Roosevelt had organized Eleanor clubs, as they were supposedly known, for, you know, a revolution, or that, you know, blacks were secretly connected to Hitler and so on. And these spread in those very particular regions or subcultures. And I don't believe that there's more conspiracy theories now than there was before. It's just that it's more visible and it's easier for them to bleed into one another.
Well, isn't it kind of ironic that blacks were seen as being involved in some conspiracy at a time and a place where they were almost powerless?
Well, I mean, but that's the nature of an enemy below theory. It's the people at the top of a social hierarchy being afraid of the people at the bottom of the social hierarchy. And those are often the most dangerous and damaging sorts of conspiracy theories.
You quote the great philosopher David Hume, who wrote, "We find human faces in the moon, armies in the clouds, and by natural propensity, if not corrected by experience and reflection, ascribe malice and goodwill to everything that hurts or pleases us." And you mentioned the demonic face that some saw in the smoke in Tower 2 on 9/11. So are humans just bound to see things where there's really nothing, or to try to find greater meaning beyond the facts themselves?
I think that, like I said, we spot patterns. We create narratives. It's what we do. It's one of the reasons why we're always going to have conspiracy theories. And all I can say is, you know, people should be suspicious of narratives, suspicious of theories. This is the kind of suspiciousness that's good. You should always be skeptical about any sort of totalizing story, whether it involves a conspiracy or not, because there's always additional signals that you're not noticing that might complicate the pattern you think you spotted.
Jesse Walker is the books editor of Reason Magazine. His latest book, The United States of Paranoia, Conspiracy Theory, it's published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.